From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up, Arkansas prepares to carry out its first executions in a decade. Despite a new state law, voters in Fayetteville pass an anti-discrimination ordinance to protect the LGBT community. The University of Arkansas system begins enrollment of its first all-online university. Democrat Connor Eldridge announces his bid for the Senate seat, now held by John Bozeman, and we'll talk with our other Senator, Tom Cotton, for his thoughts on the Iran nuclear deal. I'm Michael Hiplin. I'll be joined by Jacob Kaufman for KUAR's Week in Review podcast. It's been a decade since Arkansas last carried out an execution. This week, Governor Asa Hutchinson, at the request of Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, scheduled 8 executions to be carried out on 4 evenings, a double execution each month for the next 4 months. Jacob, this comes, as I said, at the request of the Attorney General, who says that all of these inmates have exhausted their appeals and essentially that it's time for the state to resume these.
Right, and that's a big difference from her predecessor, Republican Leslie Rutledge, the Attorney General. Dusty McDaniel, her Democratic predecessor, had said there's so much legal problems entangling the lethal injection and the death penalty in general that he didn't see a way forward to do this. We have a new governor, we have a new Attorney General, and both have said from the outset that they plan on enforcing the verdicts and the sentences that juries and judges have handed down. And she gave these. We had some notice that these would be coming in advance, and Leslie Rutledge gave these notices to the governor requesting dates to be scheduled, and he responded fairly quickly, as he said he would, with the first one in October. And as you mentioned, there'll be 8 total that have exhausted appeals. I think January is the last one scheduled.
Right, and Bruce Ward and Don Davis will be in that first double execution on October 21st. And the big problem really has had to do with the drugs needed to carry out a lethal injection. A lot of pharmaceutical companies haven't been happy about their products being used to execute someone, especially from countries in Europe that don't have the death sentence. So this year, Jacob, you were there at the legislature. They passed a law this year that allowed the state to keep secret the sources of these drugs.
And that's a tact that several other states have taken as well to try to avoid this public relations problem with some of these pharmaceutical companies. And that is one of the last remaining legal challenges that could get in the way, conceivably, of this October scheduled execution. As there's some arguments from Jeff Rosenzweig before that the state has maybe promised that they would keep the source of those drugs open, but now it'll be secret. And Michael, I had a question, I guess, about the idea of a double execution, since we'll have 4 of them. You've for some time been familiar with Arkansas's execution system. This is a fairly common idea, right?
Yeah, I covered there for a span of about 3.5 years in the mid-90s, covered all of Arkansas's executions, and many of those were double executions or even triple executions, where they would execute inmates at one-hour intervals, bring in one inmate, say, at 8 o'clock, carry out the execution, clean out the chamber, and then bring in the next inmate at 9 o'clock. Or in some cases, they would start at 7 o'clock. And it is unusual, the way it even sounds, a double execution. You almost think of two people being put to death simultaneously. But the way the Department of Correction explains this is that it's really for the benefit of the department and the state, because they have to bring in so much extra manpower to secure the prison where the death chamber is located, Cummins Prison. And they also just have to do so much to prepare that they argued, at least back in the mid-90s, that it made sense to do executions several at a time. But I know it does, especially talking about other countries that don't have the death sentence, does sound rather unusual. I know a couple of times the BBC was always really interested in talking with me when I'd be covering these executions, and I'd go on the air with them, and it just the prospect, just something about a double execution or triple execution, does strike some as odd. But what you mentioned, Jeff Rosenzweig, the attorney for the death row inmates, he has long been doing this, and he is planning to take action to try and get an injunction to at least delay these executions. He had filed suit back in June after the legislature had passed this law challenging the state being allowed to keep secret the source here, because he said you really need to know where these drugs are coming from. Make sure that it's not some fly-by-night organization. There had been a case a couple of years ago where the state had bought some of the drugs needed for this cocktail, usually three drugs that are used in the process, with the final one then stopping the heart. But apparently the source wasn't necessarily a straight pharmaceutical company. And he says we really need to know where these drugs are coming from, because you've had other executions around the country where inmates haven't died in a quick manner, where it's been stretched out, and where witnesses even said it appeared that the inmates suffered. And, of course, one of the amendments in the U.S. Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. So while some people say, well, so what if a death row inmate, someone who's committed a heinous crime, suffers a little bit, that's still protected by the Constitution, and something Rosenzweig will likely argue about. On Tuesday, Fayetteville voters ratified the city's Uniform Civil Rights Protection Ordinance. This is designed to protect gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people from discrimination in employment, housing, places of public accommodation, that sort of thing. But Jacob, this kind of is an about-face from an election that took place last fall.
Right, and this ordinance is a little bit different. It's a little bit less expansive than Fayetteville tried in the past, and all of this is in the face of a state law that authors say explicitly prevents cities from doing this kind of action. And it's similar fallout we've seen about how the issue of human sexuality extends beyond marriage sometimes, but pretty much the same turnout as last time, around 29%. Just this instance, the support and opposed sort of flipped. And there's a number of reasons for that, perhaps, but one is the Duggar family was very vocal in the past. They were not vocal this time for obvious reasons regarding their son, Josh. The Chamber of Commerce in Fayetteville also was opposed to the previous version. They support this version. They helped write it in a more inclusive way for business interests, supposedly. But Jerry Cox, a familiar face from the Conservative Christian Family Council located in Little Rock, was there, and he made the case, as they have in the past, that there isn't discrimination.
Up to this point, they've been debating this for about a year now. As far as I know, no one has been able to bring any credible evidence that anyone's being discriminated against. And so we've maintained from the very beginning that the law is absolutely unnecessary.
The FBI has some statistics on this. This is for the nation as a whole, and they say about out of hate crimes that are measured or reported as hate crimes, about 20% are said to be related to gender identity or sexual orientation. The Human Rights Campaign, obviously a biased group in all of this, they had a survey for Arkansas people in the workplace and how they felt in their doctor's office. I think it was around a quarter of those who responded said they experienced some discrimination in the workplace. So certainly people feel like they've been discriminated against anyway. And with this issue, it's hard not to blur discrimination rights with gay marriage as well, because it's kind of the issue with opponents of, well, we just fundamentally reject the idea of these alternative sexualities because of their Christian upbringing and beliefs. But I asked Cox about religious liberty. You could say that we had the example in the Kentucky clerk that I don't want to do something that violates my personal religious liberty and religious freedoms. So I asked him something that's commonly brought up about whether or not that means that you can claim religious liberty for interracial marriage as people did in the 50s and 60s.
In retrospect, it's certainly not. And I'm sure there could have been people at the time that might have said such a thing. That would have been wrong. And I think we all recognize that at this time. However, when you ask a person of Christian heritage, Jewish heritage, a lot of other faiths, it is so absolutely clear in the tenets of their faith that marriage has always been the union of a man and a woman. It's not a brand new idea. It's been the standard in Western civilization for over 1,000 years. Some people say 5,000 years, but longer than you and I have been around, that's for sure. And so I think you have to look at the fact that...
But interracial marriage is a relatively new idea, even though...
It was in the United States, but if you look at the totality of human history, it hasn't been a taboo at the level that you might find with same-sex marriage, because you find none of the world's major religions condone same-sex marriage.
So it kind of seemed like he said same-sex marriage or homosexuality is just so much more different than interracial might have been, that it has a different classification. But the Attorney General says all these municipal ordinances are unenforceable because of the new state law. We'll see what happens. Fayetteville joins Little Rock, Hot Springs, Pulaski County, and Eureka Springs.
Right, and that new state law passed by the legislature this year prohibits local municipalities from passing any kind of ordinance that offers protections to anyone or any group not already cited in state law. But, of course, we've had activists for the LGBT community point to one law in particular that focuses on bullying, and it says in that law there are references to LGBT people in that. So I guess it will eventually be up to a court to decide this state law and these local ordinances. And you also mentioned the county clerk in Kentucky. Worth noting, former Governor Mike Huckabee on Thursday was speaking in Conway and said while there that he thinks that county clerks in Arkansas could take the same position as the one in Kentucky. This has really been something he's taken on. And this week he was there in Kentucky when this clerk left jail after being jailed for several days. But it's really, he's taking this on as kind of a effort to really rally some support as he struggles in his effort to get the Republican presidential nomination.
And there's no shortage of state representatives who will also urge county clerks to do that. But I think it is important to note that both Governor Asa Hutchinson and Leslie Rutledge, the Attorney General, both Republicans, have said, hey, this is the law of the land, and county clerks need to issue these licenses.
Well, we'll talk more about politics in just a little bit. But first, Jacob, this week we had the launch of the University of Arkansas System's eVersity. This has been in the works for quite a while. It's a little behind schedule, but this is new as a standalone, fully online UA college. Of course, the different campuses around the state, including here at the UALR campus, have been offering online classes, and there's been a lot of concern. You've had people like those here at UALR who have had some trepidation, worrying this is going to cut into the student base. But this week, the new eVersity began letting students, well, what exactly did they do? They began letting students
apply to do this. And the first classes will begin in January. And they're really touting, you know, unlike brick-and-mortar campuses, you don't have to pay an intramural sports fee, a facilities fee, or anything like that. It's you're just paying for the tuition credit hours, which are around the same as you would have at any other university in the state. And they're going to have some more flexible semesters. They'll have 6 7-week semesters, I believe, or maybe it's 7 6-week semesters. So they think that it's going to get a lot of people who have already started college but stopped for whatever reason. But UALR's e-learning interim director, David Montague, he says that UALR is not really worried about this, even though the chancellor, Joel Anderson, about a year or so ago said there was some worry about students being siphoned off to that program.
If you sign up for one of the fully online programs, you actually do have a reduced flat rate tuition. It's much cheaper than taking courses face-to-face and online combined. If you do it fully online, it's much cheaper, and there's no fees.
So he seems to argue that UALR is already competitive with this as long as you make sure to go to that UALR online division and not intermix it with any of the on-campus programs.
And on the topic of higher education in the state, we got quite a few numbers from different colleges about enrollment. And one college in particular really saw a big jump.
Yeah, Southern Arkansas University in Magnolia, which we don't think about a lot. It's, you know, not the biggest college, although it does have around 4,000 plus students, so bigger than a few colleges, bigger than Hendricks College. But they saw, apparently, this is the, I think it's the third or fourth year of record enrollment for them. They had a 16.7% increase in students down there. So really big news for them. And also, we got enrollment numbers for University of Arkansas's biggest university, Fayetteville. They had almost 2% enrollment increase. They're just under 27,000 students up there in Fayetteville right now.
Well, it was made official this week. We have been hearing talk of this for about a month, but incumbent U.S. Senator John Bozeman has at least one challenger, one person vying for the Democratic nomination who would like to run against Bozeman next year. U.S. Attorney Connor Eldridge. He stepped down about a month ago, had served for the Western District of Arkansas, but officially announced this week that he will run. You spoke with him, Jacob. Sounds like he's doing his best to kind of distance himself from national Democratic figures.
Yeah, looking at his press release, talking to him for a little bit, certainly very conservative. He said a lot of things that I've heard Arkansas's Republican congressional representatives say. And, you know, I think we all knew this was coming, this announcement. Also, his son on Twitter would retweet every story about speculation he might run. So at least one family member seems like they wanted him to. But I talked to some analysts from the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, Janine Perry, and UALR, Greg Schufelt, and they both said the same thing, that it's kind of hard because we're not really in a post-Obama era, so to speak. Even though the president's not on the 2016 ballot, his legacy in many ways will be. People will be talking about the Iran deal, talking about the Obama's presidency a lot. And here's Greg Schufelt from UALR saying that a lot of Arkansas Democrats have tried to run as conservatives.
Eldridge, in a lot of ways, fits the profile of the kind of ideal Democratic candidate that successfully ran in the past or tried to run recently. But even we've seen candidates who kind of fit that ideal profile not have a lot of success. We saw that in 2014 with candidates like Nate Steele, who's the attorney general race. It's definitely going to be an uphill fight this time as well.
And Nate Steele was another prosecutor like Connor Eldridge, who's a former U.S. attorney, a little bit better than that, though, I guess. But Eldridge had a lot of really conservative stances on things like the debt and Iran. He talked a lot about cutting regulations and cutting the size of government and wasteful spending. We mentioned that he was a former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Arkansas, and that's a position you get because a president appointed you to it. And that president happens to be President Obama in 2010, and Republicans, you know, within an hour, sent out a number of press releases saying, you got your job because of your affiliation with the president. Eldridge also worked with Blanche Lincoln, former U.S. Senator, and former U.S. Representative Marion Barry. So he's casting himself as anti-Washington and anti-establishment, but he has a long track record there.
But the Republicans really saying, you worked for Obama, and there's no one, probably no political figure more unpopular in Arkansas.
Right. He directly benefited from the president's political patronage because of his association with Lincoln and Marion Barry, one could argue. But you know, Eldridge says, I worked for the people of Arkansas, and that's, I didn't work for the president, although, you know, I'm certainly happy to have gotten the position. But here's Eldridge talking about one high-profile issue that Congress is dealing with right now that likely will also come up in 2016, is the issue of Planned Parenthood.
Well, I think the videos are appalling. They're horrendous. You know, I fully support the Hyde Amendment, which ensures that, you know, no federal funds are going to be spent on abortion. You know, I think I am personally opposed to abortion. I think that there should be some exceptions for rape, incest, and life and health of the mother. You know, I feel strongly that federal funds should not go to abortion, just as the Hyde Amendment lays out. And so any legislation that comes up, I'm going to approach from that perspective.
And does that mean that you think federal funding should or should not continue going to Planned Parenthood's other services since the Hyde Amendment is already in place?
You know, the response that I have for you is that I think that federal funds should not be spent on abortion, period. I do, however, believe that we need to fund critical health services for women. And so, you know, those are the values and the positions that I have that will frame my consideration of any specific legislation that comes up in Congress over the next several weeks.
So really trying to thread the needle there a little bit. I asked him afterward in a follow-up. I got a statement back from his campaign. He does think that Roe v. Wade should not be overturned. So kind of hard to get out of all that, though, maybe.
Well, worth noting on the topic of Planned Parenthood, as we record this on Friday afternoon, Planned Parenthood has announced that the chapter that includes Arkansas has filed a federal lawsuit challenging Arkansas's cancellation of its Medicaid provider contract. Last month, Republican Asa Hutchinson ordered the Department of Human Services to terminate its contract with the organization in 30 days. That came in response to the secretly recorded videos that were released by an anti-abortion group showing Planned Parenthood officials describing how they provide fetal tissue from abortions for medical research. Those videos have been criticized as being selectively and some say misleadingly edited, but it's still been kind of a rallying cry nationwide as officials have worked to cut any funding to Planned Parenthood, even though the funding doesn't necessarily go for abortions, but it goes for the other medical services for women that Planned Parenthood does provide.
And I just wanted to note one last thing about Connor Eldridge is if it seems like we're talking about the U.S. Senate race a little early, we might be, but also the state court sort of compelled us to because we moved up the filing deadline, we moved up the primary. The filing deadline for these races is in early November, so if there's going to be an opponent to Eldridge, they'd have to announce fairly soon as well.
Well, also on the topic of the U.S. Senate, our other senator, Tom Cotton, this week announced his opposition to the moving forward of the Iran nuclear deal that was negotiated by the U.S. along with several other countries, and not happy that Congress really isn't able to step in and halt this. Chris Hickey spoke with Senator Cotton on Tuesday about this to get his thoughts. Here's what he had to say.
Thank you, Senator Cotton, for joining me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on.
It appears unlikely that Congress will be able to block the Iran nuclear deal, of which you've been one of the most vocal critics in recent months. You've said repeatedly that Iran is an outlaw terror-sponsoring regime. That being the case, what sort of additional congressional measures do you or would you like to see in the future that would address the threat of Iran on the region and Israel?
Well, regrettably, it does appear that you're correct that the Congress will not block this deal from going forward, which will make it truly historic and unprecedented in the history of American foreign policy. To have a bipartisan majority vote in both the House and the Senate, supported by a 2-to-1 majority of the American people, opposed to an international agreement, yet have that agreement go forward, has never happened before because our Constitution demands a 2-thirds vote in the Senate to ratify a treaty, which is what this agreement should have been submitted to the Senate as, to ensure there's broad bipartisan cross-regional support for these kind of very consequential international agreements. Assuming it does go forward, then I think it's very important that the Congress work with the administration and our allies in the region to take additional measures to stop Iran's regional aggression and to ensure that they don't have a nuclear breakout in the short term. So the first thing we might do is make very clear and explicit the kind of activity that we would consider to be in violation of the agreement and the immediate consequences that would flow from that agreement. Second, we need to work in an even closer fashion with allies like Israel and some of the Sunni Arab states in the region to share more intelligence so we can be sure that we're detecting both Iran's nuclear activities as well as their support for terrorism and support for proxies like Bashar al-Assad in Syria and the Shiite militias in Iraq. Third, we probably need to consider additional military support for allies like Israel, who need to not only deter the Iranian nuclear threat, but the immediate threat that Iran poses, their support for terror groups on Israel's borders like Hamas and like Hezbollah. Those are just a few of the examples of steps we could take. Ultimately, though, we'll need to repudiate this deal and actually confront Iran's regional ambitions and their nuclear program.
You recently made a visit to the Middle East. You met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. You visited the Israeli border with Gaza. You witnessed the plight of refugees in the camp in Jordan. Tell me, what did you learn from that trip, and what sort of policy proposals might we see as an outcome of your visit?
Well, I met with Prime Minister Netanyahu and many other members of the Israeli parliament, both in the majority and in the minority, met with many normal Israeli citizens who live under the constant threat of rocket fire or terrorist attacks. And one thing that struck me is just how nearly uniform opposition to this Iran deal is, from the prime minister down to the proverbial man on the street. And while they all know that the nuclear consequences are the gravest consequences, the more immediate consequences are Iran's support for terrorism and regional proxies like Bashar al-Assad. You know, I stood in the Golan Heights and saw into Syria, where there was fighting just a few months ago. I stood on the Gaza Strip border with Israel, where Hamas terrorists have been tunneling underneath the grounds to kill Israeli citizens and soldiers. So just impressed upon me how immediate the threat is to Israel. I mean, they live with a threat every single day of rockets coming over their borders or terrorists tunneling underneath those borders that the American people simply would never accept. And I think it's very important that we don't pressure them to make concessions to those terrorist groups in exchange for fleeting promises of peace, that if we're going to be a partner with Israel for peace in the region, we have to support the Israeli people as the only true democracy that respects human rights in the region.
As I'm sure you know, this year marks the 40th anniversary of the end of American involvement in the Vietnam War. And as the result of that, 40 years ago in 1975, thousands of South Vietnamese and Indochinese refugees came to the United States with the help of the U.S. government. And in fact, thousands were settled here for a brief period of time in Arkansas, in Fort Chaffee. And I'm wondering, given the vast numbers of Syrian refugees coming out of that conflict, every day we're hearing about thousands and thousands of Syrian refugees pouring into Europe, can America do more to help these refugees resettle here? And how do you see Arkansas as playing a part in that?
Well, the most important thing the United States can do to help these refugees is to help ultimately bring a fighting to the end in Syria. President Obama's policy in Syria has been flawed from the very beginning because he's essentially stood aside and watched as Bashar al-Assad massacred his own people, watched as the Islamic State rose to power and took control of much territory in Syria, watched as al-Qaeda-aligned extremists began to take control of other territory. In the end, though, with up to 4 million Syrian refugees outside the borders of Syria, another 7 million displaced inside Syria, the solution is not in the United States, it's not even in Europe, because the European Union, which announced recently are going to accept 160,000 new refugees, are still just taking a drop in the bucket of the refugee problem that Syria faces. What needs to happen is for Syrians to stay closer to their country. That's one reason why I visited the biggest refugee camp in Jordan, to hear about the conditions there and what might happen, and ultimately to be able to resettle them in a country of their own. As one Syrian refugee told me, 11 million Syrians don't want to live in Europe or the United States. They want one Syrian to leave their country so they can live in that country once again, and that one Syrian is Bashar al-Assad. Some Syrians are already going back to certain areas of the country that are under the control of local opposition forces, not the Islamic State, not al-Qaeda extremists, not Bashar al-Assad's government. The United States can do more to support those fighters. It can do more to provide safe zones with our air power and our air defenses against Bashar al-Assad's regime, which continues to indiscriminately bomb, sometimes with chemical weapons, civilians on the ground, to ultimately ensure that the best solution to any refugee problem is the solution that we can see in Syria, which is stopping the fighting and getting these people resettled in their home country.
But it seems unlikely that the conflict would end anytime soon, and thousands upon thousands are already in Europe. They've already left the Middle East. And in fact, a couple of presidential candidates, Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, have called for the U.S. to take in thousands more. Would you support, say, a presidential candidate who is advocating for taking in more Syrian refugees to the United States?
Well, we already do take in refugees, not just from Syria, but also from Iraq and Afghanistan, from Libya, all of which are caused in part by failed U.S. policies there. There are security questions here, though, because many of these refugees are coming from lands that do have a large Islamic extremist population. And ultimately, though, the numbers of refugees are simply too large for either the United States or Europe to accept and care for and to assimilate into our society. And most of these refugees don't want to do that to begin with. They want to make their life in their home where they grew up. The United States has done a tremendous amount for these refugees, not just by accepting some here in our country, but also by being the largest supporter of the refugee population in the Middle East. We've contributed over $4 billion to these camps. But all the things that we see now in Europe and in the refugee camps that I saw firsthand, those are symptoms. Those are not the disease. The ultimate disease is Bashar al-Assad and the ongoing multi-party civil war in Syria. And you don't treat symptoms. You have to treat the disease.
You mentioned that it could be a national security risk if our country was to take in more refugees. We've taken in approximately 1,400 that have resettled here among the 4 million or so that are estimated to be refugees. Could our non-committal attitude toward taking in refugees eventually backfire and causing resentment among that population who really do want to resettle?
Regrettably, I think the more likely source of resentment or anti-American feelings will be U.S. inaction in Syria over the last 4 years. Senator John McCain has made multiple trips to the refugee camps in the Middle East, and he's been told, especially in the early days of the war when the fighting was particularly brutal against some of the civilian population that didn't expect that kind of fighting, that these children are going to grow up and they are going to remember who fought for them and who didn't fight for them and stood by and let Bashar al-Assad massacre them. The refugees with whom I visited over the weekend, though, all noted that the American people have been extraordinarily generous with their support in the region and that the United States is far away. And they don't want to leave their country to try to make it all the way to the United States, or even for that matter, to make it to Europe. They simply want to return to their homeland. And many of them have already done that to areas that are under the control of the opposition that aren't scenes of active fighting. That's what we need to promote to get people back to their homes. And it's also, it's frankly, safer from a security standpoint to have local countries like Turkey and Jordan vetting them because there are longstanding family and tribal ties across those borders, where those countries are more likely to know whether a refugee is truly a refugee or is a terrorist who's trying to infiltrate their country. It's much more likely for the governments of countries like Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey to know that than it is for the governments of, say, Hungary or Germany or the United States.
All right. Senator Tom Cotton, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's KUAR's Chris Hickey talking with Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. And with that, we're done. Thanks for listening. I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
And we'll be back with you next week. If you aren't already a subscriber via iTunes, we hope you will go and subscribe to the podcast. We're here each week looking back at the previous week in news and politics. KUAR is the service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You can find us online at kuar.org. Our theme music is by our own Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.